I'm Alice.
And I'm Brett.
And this is The Prosecutor's Legal Blues. Welcome back to The Prosecutor's Legal Briefs. I'm your host, Alice, and I'm joined, as always, by my insanely smart co-host, Brett.
Aw, thank you, Alice. That's such a nice thing to say.
You see what I did there?
I see what you did there. And I appreciated it.
You get tired of me asking you every time if you get what I just did?
I mean, it does show sort of a lack of, it's sort of contradictory to what you just said, because it shows a lack of confidence in my ability to follow your brilliance.
No. Well, I trust me, I know Brett lives here, the rest of us are down here. I just get really excited about puns, but this is actually a very serious topic. If you can't tell, we're talking about insanity.
And we take it very seriously. We've talked about this before on The Prosecutors, but we decided with both some of the really tragic things that have happened, particularly out of Massachusetts, and some of the discussion over the Idaho case that we had, where we were surprised, to say the least, that Idaho doesn't have the insanity defense, that we would have a legal briefs discussion about it. So here we go.
Yes. It's somewhat shorter. It's one way to keep ourselves less sad about these like multi-episode cases when we talk about insanity. And, you know, before we started recording, we talked a little bit about the thing that we've seen when insanity comes and in our cases. And remember, insanity is different from incompetence to stand trial. Insanity is at the time, and the whole point is that you did not have your faculties to know what you were doing to be able to be held accountable criminally. And the scary thing is, we've seen it in our defendants who you would never expect it, right? People who have graduate degrees, PhDs, are doctors, are, you know, loving mothers, are loving fathers, and it really can strike anyone at any time. And so I was telling Brett, my fear is like, what if it happens to me? Like, I may not know it.
Yeah, and particularly with some of these cases, it's just, you know, look, some people suffer from mental illness because of things like substance abuse or stuff along those lines, but a lot of times it's something that maybe you've dealt with for a really long time, or something that comes about because of some major change in your life. And as we're going to talk about, true insanity is not an excuse. It's not, you know, there's this sort of idea of this person's just using this to get off, to get out of responsibility for what they did. But it's not. It's literally an inability to tell right from wrong, to conform your actions to the law. And, it, you know, one thing that's interesting that I've seen is more cases where both sides agree on insanity, and it's really not something that's contested. And they sort of go into it acknowledging that insanity, the person was insane when the crime was committed, and it's really just a question of, are they going to go into some sort of hospitalization to see if they can recover from that? And it's not as much of a contested thing is maybe you see in some of these very serious cases that often involve some sort of murder or some sort of death.
Yeah, and, you know, we're talking about insanity, but there are legal tests as to what insanity is. So it's not just something you invoke or get to invoke. There's actually a standard for it. So we'll tell you guys about it and how it applies to different cases as well.
Yeah, so let's just go ahead and walk through the legal nerd stuff before we talk about some of these cases that we're going to mention. Our favorite stuff, the legal nerd stuff. It's the best. We're going to start with everyone's favorite, I don't know, for me at least, legal test, and that's the McNaughton rule. The McNaughton test, the McNaughton rule. It's just a great name, and it comes to us all the way from jolly old England. Like so many things, the English are always, you know, making fun of our legal system, and I always want to point out to them, most of what we do is your fault, so quit making fun of us for it. And the McNaughton test is an example of that. So, who was McNaughton? So McNaughton was a Scottish woodcutter, and he actually ended up killing the secretary to the British Prime Minister. This man's name was Edward Drummond. He was actually trying to kill the prime minister at the time, Sir Robert Peel. And he believed, he was under this, I mean, this delusion that, I mean, he's just an ordinary guy. He's a woodcutter. He's not, I mean, I'm sure he was a very important person to the people who loved him, but he wasn't otherwise a very important person at all. But he had decided that Robert Peel, the prime minister of England, had decided to destroy him and was conspiring against him and was attempting to kill him and ruin him and take everything he ever had. And there was a trial. And this trial was sensational because it's not that often that you have someone who tries to kill the British prime minister. But that's what happened here. And this guy was tried, and you would fully expect he's going to be found guilty. He's going to be hanged, and that's what's going to happen when you, you know, try and kill the British prime minister in the 1800s. But in fact, he was found not guilty by reason of insanity. And the reason for that was the jury concluded that he could not appreciate that the act he was committing was wrong. He could not tell the difference between right and wrong. He fully believed this was a justified action. This was a right action. And, you know, he didn't think what he was doing was wrong. And we'll talk about some of the ways you tell that later on. And this was shocking. I mean, people were shocked by this. There were many who wanted this man executed. They wanted to send a message that you can't target the head of the British government. But either way, he's found not guilty by reason of insanity. And even though it's controversial, it really does lead to a development of a test. The House of Lords in England, they endorse this test. It becomes known as the Macnaghten rule, and it becomes the rule not only in Britain, but in the United States. And it basically has there are two aspects to it. First, the defendant must be suffering from a mental defect at the time he or she commits the criminal act. It's a pretty broad thing. Like, what is a mental defect? That's something you might debate in a trial. Is this a true mental defect? Is it something that's in the literature? Has it been seen before? That might be the kind of thing that you would do. But assume for a second that everyone agrees you have a mental defect. Say you're schizophrenic or something along those lines. Well, then there's a second part to this rule. Just because you have a mental defect, and this is really important because people miss this. People often say someone's insane and they use it in sort of the colloquial way. And they may very well have a mental defect. It may be a serious mental defect, but they also, because of that defect, have to not be able to tell that the act they committed was wrong. They don't understand the nature and quality of the act. They don't understand that the action was wrong. They have such a strong delusion that they believe they are justified in their action. And in some ways, you see this kind of trickle down into a lot of different legal principles. We've talked about self-defense before. One of the key things in self-defense is that you truly believe that your life was in danger, even if objectively it wasn't. There's that case out of Texas where someone robbed a restaurant. They had a fake gun. So objectively speaking, the person's life wasn't in danger, but they truly believed it was in danger. And so therefore they were justified in using deadly force. Similar thing here, but here you don't understand that you're wrong because of this insanity that's gripped you. And if you can show both things, then you can get this defense. It's a very high bar. It's very hard to show that you are insane under the Macnaghten test. And you have to have basically no understanding that what you're doing is morally wrong. And what you see here, oftentimes in cases involving this, the way that the prosecution will attempt to undermine this kind of defense is they will point to evidence that you did know it was wrong. So attempts to cover up the crime, attempts to escape, you know, not reporting the crime to the police. What you see in a lot of these cases is people pick up the phone and they call the police and they say, hey, I just killed these two demons or whatever, you know, because they believe what they did was fine and they have no problem reporting it to the police. And so you'll see those kind of back and forth factual questions that often come up in these cases.
And you know, what's really interesting about what Brett just said is that the legal standard for insanity is different than, say, a medical standard, right? When you go see a psychiatrist, there's usually step tests and there's like ways of rating it. And there could be numbers on a scale that have been developed by the medical field and there could be a diagnosis. The difficulty here is we are trying to see what's inside someone's mind, and you don't necessarily need a specific diagnosis to qualify as insane under the law. That's why it's called a mental defect, because you don't have to be schizophrenic, for example. You don't have to be X, Y, and Z. Now, the reports in trying to assess whether you meet this standard oftentimes will seek to diagnose you with one of those kind of known diagnoses, but that itself is not a prerequisite to be able to be deemed legally insane at the time of the crime. And you can imagine, I just said that, you know, someone gets appointed or someone, a doctor has to assess you. Something that it may jump to your mind is malingering. Malingering means you are pretending to be sicker than you are, pretending to be insane when you're not actually insane, so that you can get a diagnosis of insane at the time of the offense to get out of your charge under that. But the doctors are also trained and looking for any sort of malingering, so any inconsistencies in the way you would be acting. But this is not a science. It's kind of an art in the way that you assess. And the judge, who is not medically trained, has a role in all of this, which is really interesting. Again, judges are typically not doctors and scientists, but they ask questions to try to test whether you're malingering, to test how truthful your answers are. And they ask these questions both to the defendant who's being assessed for insanity and also the doctor who assesses them. So bringing all this in, like, it's not like a diagnosis you get at the doctor.
And it's really interesting because Alice is right. There are a lot of things they try and do to make it more scientific. You know, they have all these different tests they try and run, and they have tests for malingering, but there is a lot of subjective analysis that has to happen of those tests by the doctors. And you'll often see, this is an area where you will often have experts who are at odds. There are some cases where everyone agrees, person's incompetent or they're insane. That's great. But a lot of times you'll see competing diagnoses, one who says malingering, one who says not. I really enjoy cross-examining these doctors. It's a lot of fun because you have their report. And you're reading the report and you're seeing sort of the inconsistencies in the report and pointing that out and walking through their own report with them and trying to undermine what they've said can be a lot of fun. It's one reason other experts are so valuable too, because they can help you with that. They can say, hey, you see where he says this? Well, that really should have led him to the exact opposite conclusion that he reached. You should point that out. And then you ask them, like, well, why didn't you reach the exact opposite conclusion? And they have to come up with a reason. And if that reason is also inconsistent with their report, that's the kind of thing that can undermine them. So it is a delicate balance. It's one of those things where in some ways, everybody's kind of on the same page. The rules allow for either the defense or the prosecution to raise this issue. I mean, insanity defense is usually raised by the defense, but incompetency, the inability to even stand trial, is something that really the court, the prosecution, the defense, they're all obligated to raise to ensure that this person's constitutional rights are vindicated. So it's a very interesting, complicated, difficult area of the law. People have brought up Lori Vallow. Lori Vallow, obviously, there was a lot of questions about her competency to stand trial. The Hoggle children case, where Catherine Hoggle has been in custody for many years now, has still not revealed what she did to her children, but has been found incompetent to stand trial, much to the frustration of a lot of people who want that mystery solved. And we talked about that case, obviously, as well. But so that's sort of the McNaughton rule. And most states, the McNaughton rule has been universally accepted. It's fallen out of favor and it's kind of come roaring back. Most states now kind of use it. My understanding is Massachusetts uses it. We're going to talk about Massachusetts in a minute. But it is not the only standard that the courts have attempted to use in discussing this issue of insanity.
Yeah, like what we've said already, I mean, it's kind of already a little bit mushy. Right? It's not a perfect science equation that you can put in the inputs. You know, this person breathes this rapidly, blinks this many times, therefore is insane. You can't really do that. And so courts have kind of explored different types of defenses that wraps into this insanity. And one of these other is the irresistible impulse defense. And that's saying that the defendant can't control his or her conduct because of the mental defect or disease. Now, the advantage here is you could know what you're doing is actually wrong, like morally wrong, but you are saying that you cannot control yourself. There is no impulse control and you're able to get off despite knowing what you're doing is wrong. If this sounds like not a very fair test, then you're in line with a lot of courts because this test has almost been universally rejected since it allows someone to claim they can't help themselves when they commit crimes, which is something we hear a lot, right? Like they try to take basically the addict mentality and apply it to crimes, right? We know about addiction and that there could be situations where like an addict themselves cannot help themselves get off a substance without medical help. But then they kind of extrapolate that into the crime world. Like, I can't help myself but rape women. Like, that is, you know, that argument is the impulse defense. Like, I was abused as a child. I was raped repeatedly as a child. And as a result, I cannot control myself when I am in the room with a male, female, whatever. I cannot help myself. I turn into a monster and I just have to sexually abuse them because of my horrific mental defect based on my horrific background. There could, you know, you can see how that could develop as an argument, but I think that takes it too far, and courts have recognized that just takes it too far. And where do you draw the line with respect to how you hold people accountable? And that's why we've kind of rejected that. And we've moved forward to something else, and that's the model penal code. Before I move on, Brett, do you want to say anything about the impulse control? Because I have lots of things that I can't keep myself from doing, like eating an entire chocolate brownie when I take one bite.
It's a setup for really awful consequences, the negative externalities of that. Even if you think that's a good rule and that people who have this sort of irresistible impulse shouldn't be punished, there are so many crimes that people use, and you pointed one out, and we see that a lot with child abuse cases, sexual abuse of children. People will say they can't control themselves. Okay, that's a good reason for you to be in prison for the rest of your life. It's not a good reason for you not to be convicted of the crime and, you know, released under medical supervision or whatever.
Great. That's a great point, especially with pedophilia, which is a diagnosis as well. I see that so much in these child porn cases or child sex abuse cases, where it is true that pedophilia medically, I think, has like a diagnosis code where you're more predisposed to it. But then oftentimes the defendant will say, I can't help myself. I shouldn't be punished for it. I have a predisposition for abusing, you know, children in a sexual manner, and therefore, I shouldn't be punished for it. But, like, they're clearly a danger to society. They shouldn't be around children. And I think most people in our society would say the court should step in, even if they're claiming that they can't stop. And think about the negative externalities that Brett just said. At what point are you incentivized not to control your impulses? You know, like, if I really had to stop eating that brownie, I probably could. But if there's no, like, who cares? I'll just like run an extra mile tomorrow. You know, it's okay for me to keep eating that brownie. More so if it's a crime. Like, I know I have this proclivity to sexually abuse women. Why would I stop if in fact my proclivity is going to get me off? I might as well go full force in because it shows just how, you know, little impulse control I have, which can help me get off. You see kind of how that's a negative externality that we just wouldn't want as public policy. If we don't like that, then there's the model penal code. And the penal code is, you know, like written law as opposed to some sort of like standard coming out of the common law. And so the model penal code states that a person is not responsible for criminal conduct if at the time of such conduct as a result of mental disease or defect, he lacks substantial capacity either to appreciate the criminality, wrongfulness of his conduct, or to conform his conduct to the requirements of law. So this is sort of a combination of the two we've just talked about, but with even less of a requirement than the other tests, as it requires only substantial, not total, inability. Now, by 1980, half of the states had adopted this test. And then John Hinckley tried to kill Ronald Reagan. And he got off based on this test that I just read you. And when that happened, everyone did an about face and abandoned the model penal code and went right back to the McNaughton test that we started off this episode with.
It's kind of funny because it's sort of our version of McNaughton, where somebody tried to kill the president, but the response was not, Well, actually, you know, that seems right. We should do that. It was, that is the dumbest thing ever. We are not doing that anymore. Whoever came up with that, we're getting rid of it. And it actually, as people talked about, because of this, not only was there a swing back to the McNaughton rule, but a couple states tried to get rid of the insanity defense altogether, which we're going to mention here in a second. So there was a big backlash here. Just the notion that you could try and kill the president and claim you were insane and be found not guilty by reason of insanity, it just really hit a lot of people the wrong way. And that's a real issue with the insanity defense. Bad cases, bad facts make bad law, because obviously, I think we all believe the insanity defense is something that we have to have, that it's a constitutionally required thing. Supreme Court has said you cannot punish someone who's insane. In fact, there are death penalty cases about this. I had one of these cases, actually, where a guy had killed someone. He wasn't insane at the time. Everyone agreed on that. But by the time that he was supposed to be executed, he claimed that he had dementia to the extent he couldn't remember what he had done. So he couldn't remember the crime. And there was this whole question of, can you execute someone who didn't remember what they did? And this actually went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And he ended up dying before it got resolved. So we never actually got an answer to this question. But nevertheless, it was a sort of live controversy on this whole thing. Can you execute somebody who isn't... Literally, the Supreme Court case that talks about this is like, can you execute someone who isn't sane enough to prepare to meet their God, right? Was the way the Supreme Court talked about this. So this is an ongoing issue, really controversial, complicated thing. And most people have sort of settled on McNaughton. So how does that work? Let's say you're going to claim the insanity defense. Well, the standard for insanity is that you, as the defendant, must show by clear and convincing evidence that you are insane. This is a little different than most things in the law. Usually we think of the prosecution as having the burden to prove everything. We often say this. Defendant doesn't have to say anything. Defendant doesn't have to prove anything. Well, that's true unless it's an affirmative defense. And that's what this is. It's an affirmative defense. The burden is on the defendant. And the presumption is you are sane. That is always the presumption. You are sane. You were sane at the time of the crime. If you want to show that you weren't sane, you're going to have to do it. We talked about how bad law makes bad facts. At one point, there was also something called diminished capacity, or the Twinkie defense. You may have heard of the Twinkie defense. This actually came out of California. This was sort of a reaction to everything that was happening. They didn't really necessarily want the McNaughton rule, but diminished capacity seemed like a thing. It didn't get you off completely like the other rules. It was more like, because you had a diminished capacity, your punishment would be less. So it's sort of like, we're going to split the baby here. We're not saying you're insane. We're not saying you're not guilty, but you're guilty with diminished capacity. And the reason this is called the Twinkie defense is because it came up. Some of y'all have heard of Harvey Milk. There was a movie made a while ago that was really famous. Harvey Milk was in San Francisco. I believe he was the mayor of San Francisco. Hopefully I'm not making that up. But in any event, he was a gay rights activist, and he was actually killed by a member, I think, of the city council who was... I don't know. That guy had issues. But in the trial, he claimed that he was eating so many Twinkies that it had affected his mind. And so they called this the Twinkie defense. And it was actually pretty successful. Gotta wonder if that wasn't just an excuse for, we didn't really like Harvey Milk, so we're going to give this guy sort of a pass. But nevertheless, the fact that the Twinkie defense was successful became, number one, mocked widely in a lot of, you know, if you watch movies from that time, and also led to the death of this sort of diminished capacity aspect. So now it pretty much is either you're insane or you're sane. And if you can prove that you're insane, you may be able to get off. But if you can't, tough luck. So most states do recognize the insanity defense. In fact, all states and the federal government, with the exception of Montana, Idaho, Utah, and Kansas, recognize the insanity defense. And those states stopped recognizing it because of the whole John Hinckley thing. They decided, we're not going to do this anymore. So they changed their law. Now, what does this mean practically? We talked about this when we talked about the Idaho murders. And it was, you know, well, he can't claim insanity because they don't recognize the insanity defense. Kinda. Basically, the defense uses evidence of insanity to negate the mens rea of the case, which is what's necessary to prove the crime, which is almost exactly what you do in a standard insanity defense. The whole point of the McNaughton rule is you don't have the intent necessary to prove that you are responsible for the crime. And if you are found, they don't find you not guilty by reason of insanity because we don't have the insanity defense. So instead, they find you guilty but insane. You see this stuff in the law all the time. A difference that makes no difference.
I was going to say, a difference with no difference whatsoever.
Yeah, that's what we have. And just like not guilty by reason of insanity, if they find you guilty but insane, they sentence you to a secure mental facility instead of prison. So the practical difference is nil, and the reason for that is the Constitution. Can't execute somebody who's insane. So you want to call it something different? Great. Good for you, Idaho. But at the end of the day, if you're actually insane, that is going to be a defense.
That's a great point, too, that the arguments that the defense would make are the same, right? It all goes to mens rea. And it's probably just a vocabulary sort of thing. No one likes to say that you're not guilty when everyone knows you're the one who killed them. And so guilty but insane is really the same thing as not guilty by reason of insanity. And as the lawyer, you guys are doing the same thing to show, like, I had no intent to kill because I was so out of my mind with whatever. And so the case that comes to mind, and some of you have brought up, and is a devastating case, but really kind of flashed insanity and the McNaughton rule kind of onto the national landscape in the United States, was the Andrea Yates case. So for those of you who may not know Andrea Yates, she was a woman, a mother of five, I believe, who lived in the Houston area. And this very sad case happened in 2001. Andrea suffered from postpartum psychosis as well as schizophrenia. I think that was pretty well documented, and she was under treatment for it. And, you know, after having her last baby, she drowned her five children in the bathtub at home. And there was no question. There was absolutely no question that Andrea killed her children and intended to do so. It was not a mistake. She didn't accidentally leave them in the bathroom, leave the water running, and forget that they were taking a bath. She filled the bathtub to kill them. She even admitted to waiting until her husband left the house because she knew that if he was still in the house, he would stop her from killing her children, and she didn't want to be stopped. And although her husband, Rusty, had been instructed never to leave Andrea alone with her children because she had this documented psychosis, over time, as we see in normal life, that got more and more relaxed. You know, maybe she looked like she was doing well on her meds, and it's really hard to have five children and never leave them alone with their mother, right? There's just things to do. You got to go to work. You got to go to the grocery store. And that's exactly what happened here. Over time, you know, it got relaxed. And even though she wasn't supposed to be alone with her kids, you know, he wanted her to be more independent, and he thought she was doing well. And so he did. He left her alone with the kids. And in that, you know, short span of time is when she was able to murder all five of her children.
Yeah. And he had sort of, and this comes up a lot. People have been talking about this in the case we're going to talk about from Massachusetts, where someone is told never leave them alone with the children. In fact, this happened in the Hoggle case. It happened in the Yates case. It happened in the Massachusetts case. And in the Yates case, her husband was trying to sort of wean her into some sort of independence. So he started off with a very short period of time. So he would leave her alone. And he'd worked it up to an hour in the morning and an hour in the evening. He would leave her alone. So he'd actually set it up where when he left for work, the next person who would come would not come for an hour. And unfortunately, in that hour, and just the facts of this case are just awful. We're not going to go through the facts because I can barely even read about them. But essentially, in that hour, she drowned all five of her children.
And again, there was no question it was her. And so she was arrested. She was charged with murder, and she went to trial. And she was eventually found not guilty by reason of insanity, because this is Texas, which does recognize the insanity defense. And she has been in a mental facility since early 2000s. And every year she could actually be reviewed to see if she's competent enough to leave the facility. But she actually has waived that review every year and instead choosing to stay within that mental facility. And that's one thing I want to note, whether it's about the insanity defense or incompetency, it's not a complete get out of jail free card, even when it's just incompetence. When you're being evaluated for these things, you're not free to be out on bond. Typically, there are statutes, both federal and state, that require you to be essentially in custody. It's just a hospital custody, but you're not free to leave. You know, you have to eat whatever they give you there. You can't, you have no freedoms outside of it. And so those people who think, you know, oh, it's a get out of jail free card, it's not. Jail just kind of looks different. And a lot of our defendants who may try to be malingering and may try to use insanity or incompetence as a way to get out of their charges are shocked when they realize that they are automatically remanded, which means that they are put in handcuffs, put into a jail cell, transported to a secure facility where they're not free to leave, and they essentially are in custody and they thought they were going to get out. In those situations, honestly, a lot of people who are malingering snap out of it and say like, okay, never mind. You're right. You know, let's just move forward with my trial. Let's get through this. This is not fun. I don't want to be in a secure facility being treated as a mental health patient.
And it's, you know, it's interesting. Someone earlier on in the chat mentioned that a lot of times you may spend more time in custody as a result of these than you would if you'd just been found guilty. And that is 100% true. Maybe not in a murder type case, but in a lot of cases, that is 100% true. You end up spending a lot of time in custody. As Alice pointed out in a previous episode, that time also doesn't count towards your sentence. A lot of times, you know, if you're sitting in jail waiting to be tried, let's say you sit in jail for a year. Take a good example of this is the murderer down in Florida, the woman who killed her kids, whose name escapes me because I despise her so much. Casey Anthony. Casey Anthony was in jail for a really long time awaiting trial. So when she was finally found guilty of lying to police, she didn't have to go to prison for that because she'd already spent so much time in custody. She had done her sentence for that. And so she was released immediately. The time you spend being restored to competency doesn't count towards that. So it actually is one of those things that it is sort of an interesting and difficult to sort of wrap your head around type thing. We talked about this in the Maryland case that she was initially charged with a misdemeanor, but they were actually able to hold her for a very long time based on that. We learned after that from people that in Maryland, misdemeanors, you can get up to 3 years in prison, which Maryland, that is not a misdemeanor. Reevaluate your definition. That's a felony.
Literally, the definition of felony is like 1 year and a day in prison.
Maryland, what's going on? This is, you know, those of y'all who don't live in the United States who talk about this, our wonderful, wacky, messed up country with all our crazy laws in every state. Every state's got its own crazy laws, and that's an example of it. And that's why it's so hard to be a lawyer, because if you're anywhere other than where you are, you have to basically relearn the law in order to practice. But in any event, the Andrea Yates case, another thing that was interesting about that, she was initially tried and convicted. She was convicted by a jury, but the jury chose not to give her the death penalty because they felt like they sort of, it was almost this diminished capacity type thing where they said, look, she's guilty. She knew what she was doing, but we're not going to give her the death penalty. And that was eventually reversed because one of the experts had testified that there had been an episode, I believe, of Law and Order where in the episode of Law and Order, a mother had drowned her kids in the bathtub and had gotten off because of insanity. And the implication was that she had seen this episode and she had modeled her behavior after that, which shows she's not insane. It just shows that she planned this, and this was all a plan to be found insane. It turned out that actually her appellate counsel was able to get the showrunner for this show, who provided an affidavit that said there was never an episode like that. That never happened. And because of that, I mean, that was just defined a lie by the expert. Her initial conviction was actually overturned. And the second time she was tried, not guilty by reason of insanity, was sort of the conclusion that they reached. And that brings us, I guess, to the current case that a lot of people are talking about. Just, it's such an awful case. It's hard. I definitely did not want to do a full episode on it because it's hard for me to even read about it. I mean, this is another one of those 10 years ago, I'm sure this wouldn't have been as big a deal. But now that I have a couple kids, it's just so hard for me to even think about. And that's a Lindsay Clancy case a lot of you have been following out of Massachusetts. She has currently been charged with murder after she strangled to death her three children, her five-year-old daughter Cora, her 3-year-old son Dawson, and her 8-month-old son Callan, who did not die immediately, and I know a lot of people were hoping would recover, but unfortunately died later on in the hospital. After she did this, she attempted to take her own life. She's actually still in the hospital, so moving forward in this case is going to take a little while. And she did all this while her husband was gone for, I think, 20 minutes to go get food. It was another situation in which she wasn't supposed to be along with her kids, but she was doing this outpatient treatment. And depending on who you ask, people thought she was getting better maybe. And so 20 minutes didn't seem like enough time for something like this to happen. But then it did. I have a feeling this case is going to be one of those that generates a lot of emotion and a lot of attention as it goes forward, particularly if there's not some sort of deal reached in this case. People are already very passionate about it. I will admit, it is one of those cases that really, really is difficult for me because on the one hand, I recognize she was having a lot of trouble. Her husband put out a statement, which, God bless him, I don't think I could have put out a statement like that, that basically said this wasn't her. That this was her disease that did this, and people needed to remember that. And she was a loving mother. And it's just so awful. I mean, just such an awful thing. On the other hand, there are 3 children who are dead. And so I am not yet able to give a lot of people are jumping to conclusions on this case. I mean, there are people who are passionate about this case, who are very passionate about this because of the sort of under... We talked about this. We talked about this with the Dolly Routier case, that people just don't really pay attention to this and they don't recognize the problem, and that, frankly, medical care and mental care for mothers, all mothers, is woeful after birth. And Alice, and you've seen that. I've certainly seen that with my wife, not only mental care, but just actual physical care. It's like once the baby's born, they're like, okay, go forth. Good luck.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's a huge gap. Yeah, no, Brett's wife and I talk about it all the time, how like the mother is forgotten. Like if you were to give birth in the parking lot, they'd probably just leave the mother out there and take care of the baby. That's what it feels like as a woman in the U.S. system. You know, there have been a lot of strides, I think, that people have recognized this gap, both in physical and mental care for postpartum women. But I've seen a lot of people say, well, the baby was 7 months old, so she couldn't have been suffering from postpartum. Look at the statistics. That's not true. Postpartum depression and psychosis, especially if it's not treated or under control, spirals out of control, and it could be the rest of your life, right? It can take root very soon after birth. It can take root any time really in the year or longer after delivering. But the issue there is that it's like once it breaks, it's kind of like your heart, why you need like a defibrillator to restart your heart if it gets off rhythm. It's once it's off rhythm, it doesn't just knock itself back into place. And that's what postpartum depression is also like. You can't just will yourself back into, you know, your good mind from before you started suffering from the psychosis. And the sad part is she was trying to get help. And, you know, I think he was gone. The husband was gone 25 minutes. I mean, when you have a new baby, sure, maybe you can do DoorDash. That's really expensive, by the way, to do DoorDash for every single meal. You think, certainly, 25 minutes, I can go get food for my family. Nothing like this can happen. But I think it just puts it so starkly, especially with his words. Like, he's not only lost his 3 kids, he's lost his wife, right? The person who did this to his kids is not the person who he knows to be his wife. And she isn't. And that's why mental illness is so complex and so difficult. And it's easy for us on the outside to say she murdered and she should go away in prison for life. But like, who does that benefit? Certainly not benefiting her, doesn't bring back her kids, doesn't benefit, you know, her husband. It's just a really sad situation all around. But it's cases like these that are so stark that bring the insanity rule, I think, to the forefront of discussing it. It's important to have these rules. It's important to understand how they're applied. And it's important to understand how they can be manipulated and not swing so drastically. Like, as you've heard throughout this episode, we tend to do that. A really tragic case, and we like turn our backs on everything we've known. And we do this in the law all the time. Like, this is not new. But I just caution you against doing that, against saying, the insanity rule shouldn't exist, or that it should always exist, and or postpartum, you know, it's all difficult. It's all very difficult, and it requires a case-by-case analysis, and it requires more study, and it requires also just more understanding from the public about mental health, so that both Andrea Yates and what we have here, they were getting help. But there's a larger conversation to be had for all of us on what that will look like in the legal system. And to remember that the legal system is not the end-all be-all. It doesn't solve, like, the saddest tragedies of our society. And to remember that. You know, when we look to the justice system to solve all the ills of our society, we're in a world of hurt and a world of trouble. And that's where I think a lot of bad policies get made.
I think that's so true. Alice is always brilliant. I really shouldn't add anything, but I'll go ahead and talk anyway, because that's what I do. But, you know, there are two things I would say. Number one, I think a lot of us, there are three children who are dead, and we want our pound of flesh, right? Like, we want someone to suffer for that. You know, we want the judicial system to be able to do something. And I think a lot of people have sort of turned their anger to the husband. And they've said, how could he have left them alone for 20 minutes? How dare he? He should be punished somehow. Well, number one, he is being punished far worse than a misdemeanor, you know, child endangerment, $500 fine is ever going to do. This is certainly what he will live with for the rest of his life, goes far beyond whatever the justice system could impose on him. Number two, it's not that simple. It's never that simple. Those of you, we talked about this with the Hoggle case, where the parents did not monitor her as much as they should have. When she said she was going to take her son to get pizza, they let her go. And she comes back with no pizza and no son. And it's very easy to say, how dare they? They are guilty. They should be punished. Real life, when you're dealing with someone who is struggling with this and you're trying to be supportive and you're trying to help them, it's a lot harder than that. It is easy for a doctor to say they should never be alone. It is harder for them never to be alone. Anybody who's a parent knows this, right? I mean, you know, I want to keep my eyes on my kids all the time. And sometimes I turn around and I have no idea where they are. You know, they could be like drinking toilet water, which literally happened yesterday.
I mean, let's be honest. We are all told to put our babies on our back. Does that happen 24/7? They roll over and you don't realize they're not on their backs.
Yeah,
it happens, right? Like, that's just the reality. And so keep that in mind as well.
Yeah, and this is the more tragic the case. We talked about this with our legal briefs episode with the child cases. We have a 10-year-old who kills somebody. There is no system that is designed to deal with that. And there is no system that is designed to deal with a mother in the middle of psychosis who kills her three children. And there's no good way to deal with that. In some ways, I admire Andrea Yates for just staying in the hospital. She could fight that. She could try and be released, but she sort of, at this point, I think both has guilt over what she did and an understanding of her own mental illnesses to an extent that she stays in the hospital. And, you know, I don't know where this case is going to go. Who knows what evidence may be uncovered? There may be more to this than we even know now. It is going to be complicated, but, you know, the system is going to be strained by this one. And I think there's a good chance that when this is finished, no one is going to be satisfied.
And that's a really good point, Brett, because the system is just that. It's a system that has to work for, like, if you're looking at a bell curve, the majority of cases. And for the most part, it fits pretty well. But when you have these extremes out here, we are human and there is no system that can perfectly fit every situation, especially one that's so, so tragic. And so it's good to know that when there are cases that will leave everyone dissatisfied, like this case probably will, and the cases that have made us turn our backs on the McNaughton rule and then go back to the McNaughton rule, is that the system works for the most part for the bell curve. But there will always be the cases that are on the fringes. And those are the ones we all talk about, right? And to maybe not dismiss everything about the judicial system based on those cases, but also recognize that the judicial system was not made to answer all of our questions of, like, the tragedy of humanity.
Yeah, I think that pretty much sums it up. Alice summing it up as always. Is there anything anybody else wants us to talk about? Any final questions from the Peanut Gallery? For those of you who haven't noticed this, if you're listening to this in a couple of weeks, we're recording this live with our patrons, and they always have these amazing points and questions that they make. Someone made a really interesting point earlier that I'll just bring out about the four states that don't have not guilty by reason of insanity. If you're found guilty but insane, what would be the impact of that finding in a later crime? And that's a great question, because I have no idea what effect that would have.
It would be on your record. So it's not like it doesn't appear on your record. I think that lawyers will do what they do, which is that each side will use it to their advantage of why the prosecution will show that maybe it was malingering or, you know, there's still a danger to society. And the defense will probably say, like, once insane, always insane. So that's what I would say would probably be the effect, is that it would just be another chip kind of in this whole scheme of arguing when you're an attorney. But, oh, you guys have such good questions. It's at the end they ask all these good questions, Brett. We can keep answering these questions even after we stop recording. But before we sign off on this very important topic, Brett, do you have anything else you'd like to add?
No, just keep an open mind, see how the evidence comes out. One of the great things that I love about you guys is how respectful everyone is. I'm sure there will be a lot of discussion about this on the gallery, and there's going to be a lot of deeply held beliefs on both sides. You know, give grace to everybody, have respect for people's views, even if you think they're completely wrong and completely out there. This is a case that's going to continue to generate commentary, and once it's finished, I'm sure we will have some discussion of it as well.
Well, until next time, I'm Alice.
And I'm Brett.
And this is the Prosecutor's Legal Briefs.
Wrongly charged for murder, I would... Oh, wrongly charged. Ooh, that's hard. If I was guilty, I would want a jury trial. If I was not guilty, I would consider a bench trial. Because the judges always know you're guilty. You know, like, yes. The judge in the... What's her name? Casey Anthony case was like, this person was totally guilty. I don't understand what they were thinking. If you're guilty, go for a jury trial. You might get lucky.
Seriously, because all you'd have to do is pick one off. And people have like the weirdest proclivities of what they find offensive about the justice system and just like latch onto it and just pick one person off. That's all you need.